They
Break.
both have their ideas, and there is no passenger, and there is no machine under the human. So they both have their jobs. There is no use in a rider doing the horse's job and sorting out what is the horse's feet do. So we need a setting where the horse can improve itself, and it's the ground. And it's the ground that trains the horse, and the horse moving on the ground trains the rider.
Welcome to the Dynamics Coaching River Tiger podcast. These podcasts are about all things equestrian, especially learning and developing skills with both horses and riders.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the River Tiger podcast. My guest this week will be joining me for a discussion about biotensegrity, what it is and why it might be of interest to equestrians. So I'm absolutely delighted to introduce two guests, and I hope I pronounced their names right. One of them is Susan Lowell de Solaronzo, and she's the author of Everything Moves: How Biotensegrity Informs Human Movement. And my other guest is Maren Diehl, and she's the author of the book Beyond Biomechanics. Beyond biomechanics, sorry, biotensegrity, the new paradigm of kinematics and body awareness, which has a horse focus, which is fantastic. So welcome both of you. It'll be nice to hear a little bit more about you. So if I come to you, Susan, first, could you just tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I live in Washington, D.C., and I discovered biotensegrity, I don't know, many years ago. I always have to look up the date, but I'm a Tai Chi teacher. And through that, I was introduced to anatomy trains. And when I saw the picture, and that's Tom Myers', iconic book. Looking in there, when I found a picture of a tensegrity, I thought, I don't understand what this is. There's something about this I'm not getting. I started to explore online. I realized I needed to build a model. So I got out saws and popsicle sticks and rubber bands and all kinds of stuff. And really, by the end of that day, I was totally down the rabbit hole. I found Steve's papers, printed them all out, and I have been looking at it as a way to better understand what this was my initial thing, what the Tai Chi classics were trying to tell us about movement. Okay. So that's my background with it. And I'm lucky enough to live near Stephen M. Levin, who came up with this concept of biotensegrity back in the 70s. And I started working directly with him. And we have, together with his wife, Olga, we founded the Stephen M. Levin Biotensegrity Archive. And so that's part of my background. That's probably enough to get anybody started.
Great, thank you so much. And we will link some of these to the show notes. So if there are any open access papers, I'll put them in, but it'd be lovely to link also that archive will be fantastic. Thank you very much. Maren, it'd be lovely to hear a little bit more about you.
My start was very similar to Susan's because I also read Tom Myers' Anatomy Trains. And I thought, what is that biotensegrity thing? It seems to be important. And it was so important to me that I asked Robert Schleip from the Fascher Research in Ulm if he could recommend someone who could explain that to me. And he gave me the number of Daniel Claude Martin in Munich. And I went there for a day for a workshop. And I think I got it nearly instantly because it was a missing link for me. And since that time, I'm sort of a field researcher in biotensegrity. I tried to find out what is the difference between horses, because there are really big differences in their performance, in their habits, and their abilities. At the moment, I just teach biotensegrity, what it is about, to people without talking about horses, but everything changes. And that's a really great thing. And I do online courses about several topics, and I get a really great feedback from people. What happens when they just think in another way?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was certainly very powerful for me. I first came across it, as I've said to both of you, in the 90s, doing my research on skill acquisition through an ecological perspective or dynamical systems, as it was then, and the work of Turvey, and he introduced it as the medium of haptic perception, how we feel, how we pick up information about touch and pressure and where we are, and what our body's doing. And it blew my mind. It filled in, like both of you said, I was like, this is a missing piece for understanding the self-organization of movement and how that works, or how some of it works. But also it made me realize how important, or and how much information that a human gives to a horse when they're on it, because we communicate through haptic perception, through haptic information with the horse. We become an informationally coupled system with them. And then it made me think, what are we doing with all these cues that might not make any sense? Or they might, but I challenged myself hugely. So yes, thank you both so much. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm going to start. So I'm assuming that some of the listeners will have no idea what we're talking about. So I think it will be great. If I go to you first, Susan, just as simple as you can overview of what biotensegrity is.
Sure. Okay. Biotensegrity is the application of understanding that we gain through tensegrity to biology. So we're on a podcast, you know, so you can't see me if I'm holding up a model, but please, anybody listening, find tensegrity models, look at them, look at how they move, build one if you can. Because to understand biotensegrity, which is tensegrity in biology, you need to understand what is tensegrity. And then what I see you doing is applied biotensegrity. You're then taking this understanding that we get and you're applying it to your work. Okay, so stepping back, tensegrity is an innovation that humans seem to come up with in the last 100 years. And that is why it is such a radical paradigm shift. Okay, so thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of humans building things, a brick on a brick on a brick on a brick, towers, buildings, whatever, or slopping mud on straw or whatever it is, one thing on top of another. We then imagined that that's how our spine was made, right? And we build all these cool machines, and then we imagine that these cool machines that we've built that were probably inspired by what our bodies are doing, or birds' bodies or snakes' bodies, right? We then imagine that that machinery is inside of us. Now, tensegrity is a different way of building that didn't exist 100 years ago. And so different that the mathematicians looked at it and they said, oh my God, there's a whole bunch of new math here that we have to figure out. And I was at a book talk by Robert Connolly virtually at Cornell University yesterday. And I mean, the fact that the mathematicians saw it as a radically new thing, and the engineers and the architects. So it came out of art. But what happens in a tensegrity model is those harder pieces, the struts, the sticks, are not lying on top of each other. They're islanded, suspended in a tensional webbing of, for many models, strings, or sometimes people use rubber bands. So it's just a completely different, and they behave differently. So we study how force distributes through them, which is different from how forces get distributed through a stack of blocks. and we study just all kinds of things about the relationships. And it really is a one thing moves, everything moves system, which is a line from the Tai Chi classics. So.
Thank you. I always go to, I think Rob Gay, and I think actually you have both used this as well, the idea of a pop-up tent as something that somebody might be familiar with that could be a good place to start with thinking about what the difference between that is in your traditional one that you just sort of stand on the ground and peg, that it has a form that it doesn't matter about gravity or which way up it is, that if you press it, it pings back out again. It's trying to fill a space. So it's got that tension and pressure, the push and pull balance.
Can I jump in to say?
Yes, absolutely.
Bruce Hamilton, okay, yeah. Who worked with Buckminster Fuller and studied tensegrities and was working for, I can't remember, the tent company that first came up with those tents. He's the guy that came up with it, okay?
Oh, wow.
Because he was working with, you can go online, I think it's on YouTube, or there's websites with interviews, but because of his understanding of tensegrity, he came up with those original pop-up tent designs, which now are the only kind of tent you can find. So there is actually a historical connection. Sorry,
that's
about
very
that.
Funny because I mentioned these tents in my book, but I didn't know what you just said. I just saw these tents and I thought, oops, yes, it's very similar.
Yeah, and for the resources for this podcast,
yes,
make me find those links because they're really interesting. Bruce is a great guy. He's the guy who made like some of the more amazing, beautiful models. He's really an artist as well.
Brilliant. I will do. I'm hoping there'll be lots of fabulous resources that can go in the show notes and get people really into this topic. So Maren, have you got anything to sort of add in terms of what biotensegrity is?
Biotensegrity is a concept that you can't teach by teaching method. And I really have to say that the models are very, very important and that some people in my courses don't buy or build models and they don't understand what it all is about. And
right.
Others start with models and go on and are fascinated and build great things. And with every model, you get new insights. My first models were with rubber bands, and then I made some with cord.
Okay.
Non-elastic cords. And now I came back to rubber bands. And if you take many rubber bands and there's a very high tension, you get a very similar result as if they were non-elastics. Because when the tension is high enough, there is no more elasticity in these rubber bands.
You're at that edge.
And if you have good rubber bands, they can hold it and it really feels like strong non-elastic strings. And if you have too cheap or not many enough rubber bands, they will
snap.
Yes. And so these many, many rubber bands are used in that model. I can't show in a podcast.
we'll show the picture. I can see.
It really feels in a way that you think, yes, that's how a spine could work. So if you don't look at it and you just feel it, you think, okay, that might be how a spine feels like.
Can I jump in with that?
Yes, of course.
To say, particularly for anybody who studied haptic perception or who's studying riding the way you are, if somebody said to you, who had never been on a horse, so what's it like? Now, how long would it take for you to describe what it's like to be on a horse? Or do you just put them on the horse?
Yeah.
And until they're on the horse,
yeah,
right? You could read books all day long and think you understand the experience.
Yes.
But until your body is on that body, connected to that body, in system with that body, right? You, it's just a much more efficient way to learn the actual physical experience. And when you bother to build or at least buy and hold and explore a tensegrity, you learn things through your fingertips. It's just the most efficient way.
What you're talking about, Susan, we, and it might be the same thing, we call it the difference between knowledge about something, which is declarative, you could read it, but a knowledge of or in, which is the experience, which all a changes every time because the experience is never the same, but cannot be put into words. And they are two very different things. And most of our education is knowledge about, historically, and not knowledge of or in something. When you were talking there, I was also thinking about when we try to describe to somebody what it feels like when a horse actually lifts you up. And now I think about that from a tensegrity perspective. That, and actually my guest a couple of podcasts ago said, I don't know how to explain it or why it happens, but when the horse moves, you know, and comes up underneath me, it feels like it's expanded to fill my legs, to fill the space. The horse comes up and expands. And again, it's very much about tensegrity, isn't it? And I didn't use the words to my guests, but that was exactly what they were. I thought that was what they were trying to describe, that the horse actually takes up a space. Go on, Marin.
that experience you describe is something you can't explain by mechanical explanations. It doesn't work.
No.
And I got stuck for a long time with the problem that muscles can only shorten the body. And what I was feeling was that a good horse becomes longer and stronger, and not longer and relaxed, but longer and stronger and bigger. And there was expansion, and this expansion was not explainable by what I knew about muscles. So my reality and my knowledge really crashed into each other at that point.
And
biotensegrity explains everything.
Yeah. And it's improved integration, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? It's improved integration because everything can distribute, which also explains the haptic perception, that when I touch something with my finger, this idea that some sensation comes into the nerve on my finger, moves all the way up to my brain, which then has a little processing event, which then sends information back down to the finger. No, when I touch something with any part of my body, I touch it with all of me, to all of it, when we're optimally integrated, right?
Yes.
And I will say, Marn and I have both trained in the sort of internal Chinese martial arts, as has Daniel Claude Martin. So for us, we see that experience of partner work in the martial arts making sense through this. And then Marin has this unique background that lets her apply that to writing as well.
Thank you. I think it also, it helps recognize that the horse and the human, maybe Marin, we can talk about that a tensegrity structures can be, they could be nested, or they tend to be, you know, one inside another. So the cell inside another bit of an organ inside a body, they're all tensegrity structures that are all nested. But also when they're connected, so when a human and a horse are together, maybe even not touching completely, but certainly when they're touching, they start to behave like more like a single tensegrity structure. You can, you know, you have haptic perception moving through the whole structure, and you know, the way in which the horse needs to carry itself is going to be influenced by the human that is on it, as well as whatever equipment is being used to create a connection.
I think the best way to feel like one tensegrity one-tenth-segral unit with a horse is, I don't know if it's the right word in English, it's Chiron, the Chiron seat.
Ah, yes.
With very short stirrups.
Yes.
and very short reins, and you can ride everything with it. And there is enough space between horse and rider so they don't disturb each other. Yeah. And it's on the other hand, it's a very tight connection between them. So it's really like a tensegral unit, and even beginners can experience this with this seat. And to experience this by dressage riding with full seat, dressage seat, is really, really hard, because both human and horse start compensating their problems with each other. And so the tensegral potential can't evolve that fast.
Okay, I'm really interested in some things there. So I was always taught initially that you take the stirrups away and you learn to ride by having a deep seat. And I realized, looking at the human initially, that when the human's sitting down in a deep seat, actually most of the postural stability muscles tend to just switch off and go to sleep, and they're not doing anything, and they can use the reins to balance on. You know, so actually there wasn't an awful lot happening. Whereas when I shortened the stirrups, like you say, Maren, I got to the stage where, you know, I thought about helping somebody to develop dynamic balance and postural stability and a secure lower leg. I got them off the seat. It was like, okay, shorten your stirrups and put you in a light seat. And the results are phenomenal, because the horse can move underneath them, but also if they move around, they have to rebalance themselves. They can't just sit anymore.
And the problem is, you can learn to sit only on a horse that truly carries a rider. And if you have a horse in negative motion patterns, and I would say there are 98% of all horses in negative motion patterns, you can't sit. No matter how long and how hard you try, you can't sit that. And you can't bring a horse out of these patterns sitting.
Do you think some of the compensations that riders do, like sitting behind the movement, is them trying to do that from a sitting position? You know, when they'll sort of curl their lower spine in so that they're actually behind the movement. Do you think they use that to try and compensate for the fact that the way the horse moves doesn't allow them to sit into it?
I think it's what they've been taught how it should be like. Okay. It's one thing. And if you have horse in negative motion patterns, there is nothing you can sit on. You always fall into this hole in the second half, of the saddle. And a horse in positive motion patterns, it carries the saddle, the whole saddle, and you can sit on these horses. But that's what I'm looking for, the strong and reliable horse. And it's nearly impossible to get such a horse using the methods we know. What people learn usually when they start to ride is how to teach a horse how to move. And people learn it even when they start, and that's just impossible. It's so human.
Yeah. I don't know if either of you read my first paper for my PhD, but the gist of that is, like, we don't even know how we move. How on earth do we assume understand how a horse moves, what its action capabilities are at that moment in time, what it perceives or how it needs to move? And when you start thinking about that, you're just like, oh my goodness, why did I think like that?
I hope everyone's read that paper who's listening to this. It's really, really brilliantly written, and so many good points. And I think, so I have been on a horse, but I am not an equestrian. Okay. We have to go back to my high school days or whatever, but I think part of what you're kind of getting at here, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if the horse, if any being has integration patterns that are suboptimal, okay, let's say, that are unhealthy, that are filled with compensations or a complexity of compensation on top of compensation, right? You can't fix that by getting on it and doing something.
Yeah.
And there's a whole thing going on in the field of physiotherapy right now, people who are doing biotensegrity-informed physical therapy, where they're exploring what Leonid Bloom calls the unreasonable effectiveness of light touch. Well, getting on a horse is not light touch. So then I think people listening might be wondering, what do you do? And it would seem to me that you would need to help establish a relationship with the creature and the connections without being on top of them, in order for them to find their way back to their, and you mentioned a state of play at some point in the conversation earlier. When we're in a state of play, we can learn faster, we can be more natural, we can be efficient, and we don't have to be working and doing to fix. We can just be in the state of play, and naturally that improvement in the overall condition can arise.
Yes, and the biggest enemy of evolving that tensegral potential is doing things right. Just make your efforts without killing you and your horse. So take care for the setting before you start trying, and then it's the rider's job to stay on the horse and the horse's job to carry the rider. And if you stick to these basics for the first weeks, then things improve dramatically. And it sounds so funny, but it's the way.
Yes. Learn to be a good passenger and understand what that means, maybe?
No, I think if rider and horse try to become one, they both have their ideas, and there is no passenger, and there is no machine under the human. So they both have their jobs. There is no use in a rider doing the horse's job and sorting out what the horse's feet do. So we need a setting where the horse can improve itself, and it's the ground, and it's the ground that trains the horse, and the horse moving on the ground trains the rider.
Sorry, I stepped on Marin there, but it is, could you say it's more collaboration? And it sounds like what Marin's saying is the human's foot isn't on the ground, right? So when you talk about this, when you write about this in your paper, Marianne, right? The horse knows things about the jump that may or may not happen that the human can't know, because they're reading the ground. They know how they feel. They know the distance between them and the log or the puddle or whatever it is. It seems to me that it needs to be a respectful collaboration.
And it's hard to find analogies, isn't it, for that? Because even in dance, there's often, you know, there's a, okay, you can have a leader. I have started thinking about it. I don't know if either of you watch Strictly. Strictly Come Dancing, I love, and it's something that's on here. But last year they had two men doing a same-sex couple dance. And I thought that was closer, because they would take it in turns. They would swap constantly. And it was never an all one way or an all the other. And I thought that feels like it. Sometimes, you know, the human will go, we're going this direction, and the horse says, oh, I need to solve this problem, or mm-hmm. I need to find this solution, mm-hmm. you know, get over the terrain, like you say. To and Maren, if I come back to what I think I heard you say, and please correct me if it's not right, that we need to set something that the horse understands as an outcome, as a purpose, move over here, over that terrain, or mm-hmm. go around this, or go over this, so that the horse can actually have some ability to be a collaborator rather than mindlessly waiting for another bit of micromanagement, because it makes no sense to the horse what it's trying to do.
I think it can learn to realize what direction I want to ride. And I can train a horse to do the gates, walk, trot, gallop, and whatever when I ask it. But there is no use in telling the horse how to trot or how to gallop according to its whole motion. I can tell him, okay, we go slower, we go faster, we go that direction or this direction. We change gates, but it doesn't make any sense to tell the horse how to use its body.
So I guess one of the million-dollar questions is, how can we change the way in which we train or interact with our horses to access this, to better help them move, help us understand how they move? And you talked about maybe starting on the ground with a horse.
I wouldn't start on the ground, but it starts with the ground.
Okay.
For the horse, it starts with the ground. And of course, there should be a relationship between horse and human that the horse is able to follow, to go for a walk and everything, and without being afraid. And but then it really starts with doing things together. And I have had several courses about biotensegrity and some online coachings for riders. And it all end up with very simple things. There were two women who started their young horses and was, okay, you can saddle the horse, everything is fine. The horse can go all gates with a saddle on its back in the riding arena. And it accepts a rider mounting and dismounting. And then you can start to go for a walk and to go to a place where you feel safe, and you get on your horse and you get off your horse and you walk on, and you do this several times until you know, okay, it's fine for the horse that I get up and down. Everything's right. And the next time you ask the horse, say, I'm a little bit slow, maybe you carry me. And you start walking and trotting. And as soon as you can trot with your horse, it makes sense to ride the trot and walk the walk. And horses learn so fast. And there is the moment when the horse says, okay, and now we could try some gallop. It's very soon. And it's safe. Because the horse says, I think it's okay to try that now. I think I can do it. And not the rider on top says, I think I can do it. The horse has to say, I think I can do it. And the rider can say, oh, no, I'm afraid. Please, not now. That's your right as a rider.
Can I ask? Yeah. Because it sounds radical what you're suggesting, Maren. So I want to know, is it radical? That the first thing I do is just walk with the horse. And then I get on and off.
It's how it all started.
I get on and off, and I don't even try to ride, just get on and off and get that part. I mean, it makes so much sense, you know.
That's how it all started some 10,000 years ago.
I tutor kids with math sometimes, okay? It's just something I've done for many years. And these kids will come in with like all these complex problems, and it's like, if you don't know how to count by two, there is no reason for you to be given this math problem. We've got to get you back to, can you count by two? Can you add? Can you multiply?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can't do that, why would I be pushing you into more advanced concepts? So to go back to the very basics to me is, sometimes people think it's a waste of time, it's the kids stuff, but it's absolutely fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what you're doing, Maren, would you say?
Yes. And the funny thing is, it works with everyone. It works with beginners who were crazy enough to buy an own horse. And it also works with people who say, I've tried everything, every riding style, and the more I trained and tried, the worse it became. And now I do something else. And they start like that with horses who are nearly don't move. And they start like this, and the horses improve and improve and improve. And it's really great to see how they reorganize themselves and get a completely different understanding of their own body and of their own job.
I have a question that I'm trying not to make a statement. So that is a question. Do you think that even just that slight change in that sort of collaboration, in that listening to the horse, in that paying attention to what they are offering or are happy to offer, makes a huge difference? Because the horse for a horse, moving around is risky, isn't it? It's always a risk, especially if it's out of balance. And having less control over its movements, I'm guessing, would feel more scary to the horse. Yeah, just in how they feel, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The threat level of being asked to move with a human.
But it's a very dangerous thing to put all that stuff off and try to perform the same lectures you did before. If you put off all your regulation, you have to go back to the beginning and give a chance to the horse to learn how to control its own body, because one of both has to, and it can't be the rider. But the horse needs time to learn to control its own body in every situation. And that's why I said, don't try to control the horse's feet, try to control the setting. Find a safe setting for your next step, so you don't have to control the horse, but the horse has the chance to learn how to control its own body and its interaction with the ground.
It might be different and scary for both the horse and rider. Initially, it's
if you go back to the really beginning, it's not scary.
No,
but if you try to start skip right. That it's scary.
I think, yeah, what I say, ask, it's really important to go back and not just take everything off and say, look, it doesn't work, and just go back on again. So, one of the things that I'm kind of curious about, and I'm asking this in a sort of, because of the experience I've had with one of my horses who got very poorly. So I bred her. So there's nothing, you know, that I know of that's happened in the past. I can't go, oh, she's had terrible experiences. I don't know what's happened. I bred her. But she was very, very poorly when my son was poorly, actually, and I was away. And she ended up ill for about 6 weeks, on antibiotics for about 6 weeks. Then she got ulcers because she was on antibiotics for 6 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. And she just seemed to lose all her stuffing. If you kind of think, she just changed. She looked like she'd lost not just the muscle tone, but also her joie de vivre, really, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me start thinking about, I not so much anatomy trains, but the anatomy of agility. So Franz Bosch, who's also influenced by, you know, Tom Myers and similar things, would talk about the residual tension, that biotensegrity tension within a system, that if there was too much slack in the system, then there would be nothing and it would jar. And of course, that would cause problems. It also means that you can't transfer power through a system if it's compromised as a tensegrity system. And then if there's too much tension in some places, you still can't do that. So I started paying attention to how she looked as a whole biotin integrity system, and starting to design our practice, sometimes on a lunch, sometimes it would be, you know, just at liberty, sometimes it would be ridden, so that I was creating movement puzzles for her to solve that she was finding interesting and engaging and fun. But I stopped paying attention to where she, what, and she, I think she's a bit hypermobile as well, you know. So sometimes I look at her and I go, why have you got your feet like that? You know, your legs. And I was like, well, because you can, you know, she's So again, I thought she needs more tension in her system to protect that hypermobility as well, or two. So yeah, sorry, it's a long description, a long ramble into a question of what would be indications of there being problems with it, that tension, whether it's tight bits or it's too slack, or is that something you think about or pay attention to?
I would pay attention to that to get a feel for it. And I think for every horse, it's very important to have some inspiration. So what you did with doing several things is completely right, to find out what is good for the horse, what it is interested in. And I think one of the main problems is that it's so hard to do the step to stress the system.
Okay.
So if everything is fine and easy and careful, the system can't improve. It will stay the same always.
We need to challenge the system.
Yes, you need to challenge the system. And so if you have a hill to ride up, it's a challenge for the system, because it has to reorganize in another way than on the flat. And if you have different sorts of ground, hard ground, soft ground, wet, dry, stony, whatever, it all challenges the system. And I see so many riders doing the same every day, more or less, or they do different things, but there is no training effect, because everything is too soft and it doesn't come to the point that the system has to reorganize and even rebuild itself.
No, I was going to say, this is where we move from a tensegrity structure like a bridge or something into a biotensegrity structure. Yeah. Has the ability to adapt and become stronger and become anti-fragile and things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that's what where I was going in the discussion, right? So this is getting into, and you mentioned it in at least one of the podcasts, you talked about the concept of anti-fragility, which anybody who doesn't know about it, I would encourage them to look into, and also the concept of flow. So to me, they're related here, because the other thing is that it, as I was saying before, so you're talking about presenting this horse that was having difficulty with puzzles to solve that the horse enjoyed. So here we can be in a state of flow, in a state of play, in a state where time feels like it's disappearing. I don't know how time feels to a horse, but because we're so engaged that we're whole system engaged, right? And we're happily engaged, and we're right at that perfect little sweet spot. Because if you took that horse, you were talking about riding up a hill, Maren. Okay, if you took that horse to a wall where goats are climbing and you said, okay, now go here. No, that's ridiculous. That's too far. That's too much.
Would be too early.
Yes, maybe it could get there, but it can't get there.
Not impossible, but too early.
Exactly. And Maren, you also said earlier, you know, you do all this with the horse and then it's walking and trotting. And then the horse is saying, maybe we could gallop now. Okay, it's coming from them that they know they want to explore that next challenge. And that is a state of, I think, health. That's a marker, I would say, of health. I think we have to, it's important to distinguish between like a medical condition where you may need a acupuncturist or a massage therapist for the horse or something like that, and a training problem. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, I think it's important to kind of be aware of where those edges might be, but a sad horse or a sad critter of any kind, human or otherwise, there's some barriers to health there.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you get to help and state of play and relaxation and integration? And by relaxation, I don't mean collapsed like a puddle. I mean, you know, happily engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandsons come over and they run for the joy of it. That's it. Not, oh God, I've got to get up and run again. Okay, I'm running. Okay. No bliss there.
We can learn a lot from children, can't we? Yeah. I've listening to you there, one of the things that I've started doing with the jumping is allowing my horse to, again, almost choose not so much the gait, but also other parts of that. So for example, if my jump's a little, both my horses tend to be like, nah, whatever, I can step over it, trotting's fine. And I'm like, that's okay, that's functional, it makes sense. They're clearly not going to knock it over. And then there will be points. And again, I think about this from a systems perspective. It's like it's a metastable region where the horse might be, maybe I need to put a bit more power in my canter. Otherwise, it's going to be too effortful to get over there. And that's where I'll check. So I don't have to go any higher, but if I try and make them do a power canter to a small jump, it kind of doesn't make sense. So I just keep popping the jump up. Obviously, I allow them to choose whether they go over it or not. And they're like, oh, this gets more interesting. And actually, both of them get much more engaged when it gets bigger. And they choose to change the nature of their canter. They increase, like you say, they puff up. They increase their volume, as it were. They bounce more and they put more speed into the canter to go to the jumps. But they've chosen to do that. If I put the jumps back down again, they'll stay there a bit longer so I can get nicer technique over smaller jumps on the way down. Proper hysteresis. But then it'll get smaller and they're like, nah, I might as well trot over this again. And I found that fascinating and much nicer than me trying to tell them the quality of their gait into a jump. They choose, and that, yeah, it seems to be working.
You designed the setting, what I said before. This is also design of the setting, and let the horse do what it thinks would be fine, suitable. And I also know a horse who did the jumps fine for 2 times, maybe 3 times, and then chaos. He started to try what it is like when he goes very close to the jump, or from very far away. Oops, rap off, kaput. Or how to jump diagonal, or how it is to jump about the
wings.
Yeah. So when I didn't change anything, he started to change what he was doing. And that was nearly the same thing as you described.
Yes. And now I would love that, because I'm thinking now my horse is A, making decisions, but also in future, for example, in a competition, they can get themselves out of trouble. My horse mm-hmm. knows a much mm-hmm. wider, toolkit's the wrong thing, but it has a much bigger movement capacity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Back to the anti-fragility again as
yeah.
well. Increasing movements and possibilities and degrees of freedom. Yeah, I find that instead of you going, oh, that's wrong, you need to do it like mm-hmm. this, I kind of look at it and go, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and you don't learn anything by doing it right every time. Doing it everything right in the same way is the worst thing you can do with a horse.
But it's traditionally how we're, well, and humans, it's traditionally how coaches are taught, and not, you know, and also I think psychologically it's damaging because everything you do, you're being corrected rather than everything you're doing is this expansion of movement ability. And then, and it's almost like we prune the tree and then go, oh, why aren't they creative and agile and anti-fragile? Duh.
It's interesting because when we do Tai Chi, for example, you're doing the form and you know, and it should be different every time. It looks to somebody who doesn't know what's going on internally like we're doing the same thing every time. I've had students say, you know, this is it. You just keep doing this. Yes. And no, because every time it's different. And if you're in a situation, I've thought about this with sports, you know, and sports training, and people get, or even typing, people get repetitive use injuries. Why? Because they're trying to make themselves like a machine. Okay, a machine, when you go to get in the car and you turn it on, you know, these days push a button rather than turn a key or whatever, you want everything to be exactly precise, exactly the same every time. When it gets a little out, you want to put it right back to where it was. You want no tolerances in the system. And that's what a machine, that's how a machine works. Well, if you look at the body that way and you don't recognize that every time you kick the ball or you know, swim across the pool or the pond or whatever it is, run the mile. Every time it's different. Every step is different. Every breath is different. If you are not willing to recognize that and you're trying to do a machine model, yeah, you're going to get injury, I think. And you're not going to be able to do as well, right? You're going to miss out on so much of the joy of doing it, and you're going to miss out on those bizarre opportunities where all of a sudden, whoa, where did that come out of? You close that door.
I like that analogy. So clearly, you want your wheels correctly aligned in your vehicle, but we don't have wheels. We don't want, you know, it's the important thing is that we have lots of different movements. I mean, even getting away from these ideas of perfect posture, you should sit there with, you know, decorum and this perfect posture, how bad that is for us.
Are the recognition, here's just another way to put it, that we are far from equilibrium systems as opposed to static, rigid, regulated, highly constrained equilibrium systems. And I know both of you have studied systems.
So, and it'll be interesting to hear what you two think of this. So now, certainly in my coaching or anything else I do, instead of looking for the one correct way to do something when I'm first observing, I look at how much variability there is. And if I see, it doesn't matter whether it's an athlete, it's, you know, whether they're a paddler or a climber or a horse, if I see them repeating the same solution, doing the same thing, regard, you know, like they did last time, the same way, then the alarm bells go off in my head. And that's what I want to fix. I'm like, I need to open up these movement possibilities. So, for example, in paddling, it might be somebody who always breaks into the flow and breaks out the same way, even though it's a different flow. And there are hundreds of different ways to do this, always the same rhythm. So, the things that I would have once looked for, I now, you know, I would have once tried to control and now completely opposite. I literally look through a totally different lens.
I think this is Marin's control the setting, right? He
And people always hated me for saying just do some different thoughts, not always the same thought.
Yes. If it's too similar, perturb the system, change the setting.
Yeah.
We, you know, that is what we would call a constraints-based coaching. Mm-hmm. It is an activity design, a setting designer. As mm-hmm. a coach, we don't do nothing. We create a setting that we, mm-hmm. that we hope will support the learning that we think needs, mm-hmm. or at least be a challenge. And then we'll watch and go, oh, that's interesting. You know, what we get is information, like we said earlier, about what that system or what that whether it's a human or a horse, what is their best solution at that time is what we're seeing, not what's wrong or right. And then you work from there.
Because they don't realize, I mean, humans in this situation, they don't realize how much they've locked themselves in, okay? I taught music in schools for several years. Okay. And I worked at one school where there were some kids who were literally the rock stars, you know, the lead guitarist, and they had a band and they got all this attention from the previous music teacher, and the other kids were pretty much ignored. And I just, you know, have a different way of doing things. So I challenged them one day. I said, we're breaking into groups. I'm going to give you instruments and you're going to compose a little improv piece and then perform it. Okay, just a minute and a half, 2 minute piece. And you know, the lead guitar player, I gave him a shoebox with three rubber bands. Okay. And I gave the drummer like two wooden blocks. You know, I mean, I gave them just completely basic and different kinds of things where, and they were so mad. You know, I know how to play the electric guitar, and now you want me to play a shoebox with rubber bands? But something came out of it that was really incredible. And after they finished being pissed off, they opened up. They would never give themselves permission to go into that playground. So that's constraints that sometimes Maren says, and they get really mad because people don't like to be in a, you know, when people find a comfortable zone, oh, I'm an expert here. It's sort of like they don't want to be looking like a kid again.
But I think when they try, they learn that they can trust their abilities and not the instrument. And that's another great thing with biotic integrity and all these ideas about ground reaction forces, that people start trusting their horses. They say, okay, now that I know this, I think you can manage this. We could try. And the horse says, of course I can. You never asked. And I think you all have seen Lord of the Rings, part two, the fight at Helm's Klamm, when finally Gandalf and the Edingar or whatever, right down that steep slope. Yes. And one of the participants in my workshop posted this photo for, okay, we will do it finally. And another one day later, posted her ride from the day before with a tracking app where you could see the mountains, how they went up and down. And what she posted was the same slope as you could see in Lord of the Rings. Okay, they didn't gallop, but they made it.
I'm trying to think, you could go down in so many different directions, but what's in my head at the moment listening to that is a recognition that what a lot of horses experience is that they're born on a flat, soft surface. So the minute their little hooves hit the ground, there isn't really any good stimulus for them to adapt.
Yeah.
Then they go outside on a nice, flat little handkerchief of a field. And many horses, like you say, then they live in a stable with a soft surface and they have tracks of a surface that's the same as the surface in the arena that they're going to work on.
Mm-hmm.
That is the only ground that they're on. And yeah, just thinking about all the implications that has for creating fragile systems, movement systems. and just, you know, like even probably just walking around rough terrain or climbing up tracks and paths would be, like you say, man, they, you know, like the many people probably think, gosh, my horse could never do that. But of course they can with practice.
Yes, just a matter of changing things in an appropriate way.
In a natural setting, right? They'd be running all over the place, going wherever they wanted, you know, ups and downs and overs and unders and whatever.
And sometimes it's helpful that the human doesn't know what that horse can do. I had to train a horse once, and it was in winter, and it was raining at night, and there was ice on the whole ground, and I had to pass that ice to get into the riding arena. And we went over from the stable to the riding arena, no problem. And later the owner came and said, how did you get here? We walked, no problem, no slipping, nothing. And she couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe that a horse can walk on ice without breaking all its legs.